Ash, happy new year. It's 2024 in the middle of January already. How did that happen?
Yep, and it's so cold, but yeah, happy new year. And it's been just like somehow or another, we got caught up with all of our post-dated episodes right towards the end of the year, all thanks to you. That was like really cool. I think maybe like the last one came in right on the last day of the year, and that was
right
a surprise.
Under the wire.
That was a surprise in my own podcast feed. I was like, oh, hey, it's I'd Rather Be Scripting. So yeah, thanks. That was really cool.
Yeah, I figured, well, if I wanted to keep 14, I think we had 14 episodes in season two. And if each season is a year, it's got to get there right under the wire. And so being on company break and holiday break meant I had some spare time.
Yeah, having spare time to play with different things or just like knock out some projects and stuff was awesome. I see you like rearranged your entire office and
I did.
Like you told me basically what I asked you is like, well, are you in the same room? And you're like, same room, but everything has been rotated by 90 degrees. And I'm like, that's like really interesting way to put it.
It's the easiest way to explain it. But man, it was, it took a little bit of effort, had to take things. Cause this for listeners who can't see my office, it's a narrow but long office. And so rotating things, rotating the layout is not the easiest thing in the world. So I actually had to, I have two desks in here and I have a piano in here and a few other miscellany. And in order to make this work, I had to take the piano all of the way out of the room, unload every piece of surface, and then push everything around, bring the piano back in. It took the whole day, which is why I did it during the break, because trying to do that between meetings is not going to happen.
Yeah, that makes sense. I did something similar, but not the same, which was like, even though my office looks the same, I took everything out of it and then put it all back in. Partially because I'm a big end of year cleaning fanatic, mm-hmm. as my traumatized family can attest to every year. Everything must be touched and dusted, or like, you know, and a case must be made for why we still have it. Same goes for my office. So it's interesting because I was thinking like, oh, this is sort of like, well, you know, that thing called that concept called Ship of Theseus.
Uh-huh.
Where so like the Ship of Theseus, the best example of it that I can think of that I'm aware of kind of in my own world, is the Issei Shrine in Japan. So not really my world, I guess, but like we used to live relatively close to that. And the idea is like, I don't remember exactly what the cadence is, but I think it's like tens of years, maybe like 20 years. They take the whole thing apart and then rebuild it from the original plans with new materials.
Oh, wow.
And so this is like Ship of Theseus is that kind of concept. It's like basically if you take all of the things, you know, that made it originally and remove it, is that really the same thing or is it something different? And other things that, you know, might come to mind there are things like the human body, right? Like,
right,
if all of your cells get replenished, supposedly they do, I have no idea, but if they get replenished every, you know, some number of years, are you really the same person that you were 10 years ago? That kind of thing.
It destroys my brain anytime I think about it, because that comes up a few times, even like in sci-fi, of course, is, oh, if all the stuff that makes you is no longer part of you, like Star Trek and Transporters, right? Are you still you? And yes, Ship of Theseus stuff is mind-bending.
So my office is a less complex
less
version
severe
of that
form.
Because I just took everything out and then put it back in. So it is not really Ship of Theseus at all. But for a split second there, I was like, And then I was like, nope. Because these are all the same things that I had in here before, pretty much arranged in exactly the same way. But the one thing that I took out of here that I did not have to bring back in was my old monitor stand. So I have a buddy who printed me out a monitor stand years ago. Like this is probably like 8 years ago now. And I had measured exactly how high I wanted. He had a 3D printer in his house, so he printed it out. Thank you, Winston. So, like, got that and had it forever. But I finally decided to pull the trigger on getting are they called Visa mounts?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So those are the arms, right? That you can move your monitor around with. And the mobility of the monitor has been nice, but honestly, it's just the saved desk space that has been like really big for me. Cause I'm in, you know, I think you and I both are relatively similar situations in terms of like square footage of our office spaces.
Yes.
I think yours is slightly bigger than mine, but like similar thing. So it's like every little, where you put an object really ends up mattering. And if something's taking up quote unquote floor space or desk space, that starts to matter. So now I actually have like a little more room to work on this desk, thanks to the Visa mount. And of course I did a lot of cable management along the way.
Oh, I would expect nothing less. That sounds interesting. Cause I've thought about trying that on my desk. My desk isn't terribly wide, and so having some room underneath the monitor would be nice. And this is an LG, or my main monitor is an LG monitor. After Apple stopped making monitors and before they started studio displays, I got one of the LGs. And it's really nice, but its stand takes up a whole honking lot of space on my desk. So I've thought about considering something along those lines. I'll be curious to see how it works out in practice.
Yeah, so far so good. I you know, I've only been back at work for this last week after the vacation. So that having been said, like, it's been perfectly not front of mind, which is exactly what you want in a thing holding up your monitor. So like, it's not something I've had to spend a ton of time thinking about, but it's the gained desk space that's made a huge difference in my life. So you know, given that I've only had it here for, you know, let's call it 2 weeks ish, maybe a little bit more than that. I don't know if this is a whole like full throated sort of endorsement, but the one that I got was the Jarvis arm thing. Ooh. That you can find on Herman Miller's website. And that's a pretty good one. So I would assume for something like this, you kind of want to get something that, you know, won't eventually drop your monitor on you. So
especially with how expensive some of these monitors are.
Yes. And eventually my hope is that I will have an Apple Studio Display too, if they get around to shipping one that doesn't have a horrible camera in it. I will be there on day one to buy that. And when I do, I'll be clicking the button that says Visa mount, because that'll be great. So
plus you'll really save excited. Some on the stand.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's true, right? I don't know, but maybe like I'd have to go back and look, right? So there are two options for stands. One I know is the upsell stand.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
I don't know if they like reimburse part of the price if you don't get a stand, but something would tell me they absolutely not. Do not.
It would be nice, but maybe not.
Yeah, I don't
know.
It would
be a little uncharacteristic, maybe.
Look, just give me Apple Studio 2 display. I think that's really I'm hoping for, and all I've been hoping for, which I don't know if that I just don't want to wait until 2025, but I absolutely will if I have to. So
yeah, I've been thinking about getting another one, because for my setup behind me, I actually have an older Dell 4K display, which works, but I very quickly run into the challenge of it's just on the cusp that it took me a lot of finagling with trying to find a cable that would even work to do 4K 60. And I've never had that problem with the LG because it's Thunderbolt. But with going back, trying to get it to work with HDMI and everything was a pain in the rear. And it's like, well, I could update my display. Or do I just want to wait for a studio display that I actually like? We'll see.
Having everything be Thunderbolt would be so nice. I've been playing a lot of input Jenga, I guess, where it's just like, so I have this Dell 4K 23-inch monitor, and it is one of those things where it has a handful of USB-C ports, not all of which will do all the things you need. Nope. And then there's like some USB-A ports, and it does have HDMI, but like for most of my use cases, like just HDMI, like all that is a like a visual port, right, for lack of a video port, right? So like I don't want that. Like everything I want these things to do now, I've been kind of spoiled by USB-C in some ways, because like it can do the power and X, Y, and Z. So the trick, of course, is trying to figure out which things can I shuffle off to the USB-A ones, ports, and then which ones can I do what thing with on USB-C. Yes. And I just would really relish it if I never had to think about USB-A again.
It would be so nice. When I was putting the office back together again, I had to think about USB-A again, because of course I had to unplug everything. And it's like, especially on the monitor behind me, your Dell might be like this too, because where they put all the ports is up under the edge on the back, and you can't see where you're aiming your wires. And it finally took me to get my phone, and I put the front facing camera on so I could stare at my phone and try to angle it in the right direction. And I still got it wrong like every other time. It's like, USB-C and Thunderbolt has totally won over in my heart. I just wish, what I would really love is, and Apple, please make this, but what I would really like is a Thunderbolt display with a built-in switch to go between two or more devices. So like I could have, say, work and personal machine plugged into my main monitor, and with a click of a button switch between the two without having to worry about switching all the cables or whatnot. I think that would be kind of fun. I know they make some that are separate KVMs, but I don't know how that works with power delivery and stuff.
Maybe you know because
you have a KVM, don't you?
I do know, and so like there's a, so regular KVMs, power delivery is whatever it currently has the focus of the KVM is the only thing that's getting powered.
Ah.
That having been said, there are a different type of KVM out there that have some sort of alphabet soup acronym name, KVM with, I don't know, LMNOP. And whatever LMNOP is, I don't have this. This is why I don't know yet, but I was looking into this recently. That's the one that will keep the connection alive and will even virtualize, like it'll help your computer still think it's actually showing something on the external display as well. So that way you're not worried about power, but you're also not worried about like the, let's wait for a minute while my windows like shuffle all over the place after I switch.
And hope that your windows shuffle into the right spot after you switch, which Mac is not always, I mean, Windows has its problems there too. I don't think that's a solved problem on most environments. Maybe Linux has figured that out.
sure it has. I won't know, but like, I don't know if long shot here, but if anybody has like a KVM with LMNOP, whatever that is, I'd love to know what your mileage is, because I just got the KVM switch that I have. I just got sometime in the fall. And I already don't love it for various reasons, including like reliability is one, power delivery is another. One thing that I've started to realize is that if I'm plugged in a laptop to the KVM and everything's running off the laptop, if the laptop's battery is not fully charged, I also need to plug in the other USB-C port on the laptop into power. Otherwise, the monitor connection will flake out periodically.
Oh, well, that's not fun.
Yeah, so there's a few things like that. The other one is, I mentioned this partially, not, you know, just to be sad about my KVM, but also in case someone's looking into this, you want a KVM that has a switch that comes to you. Carrie, I think you and I did talk about this at some point, and you found one like that, and I need to go back and find out which one that is, because what I have to do now is kind of like reach back. The KVM ends up between at the elbow of my arm, the Visa mount, and I have to kind of reach back there and flip the switch in order to switch computers.
Which is less than ideal.
less than ideal. Not the worst problems to have. I mean, it's still way better than doing all the juggling every day of all these different cables, but it's, you know, it could still be better. And apparently that technology exists.
Yeah, I vaguely remember the one you were that you're thinking of. I think it had a cable that would run a switch out where that, and you could put it wherever you wanted, like next to your keyboard or something, if I remember right. And that is a good point, because if you're going to switch often, you don't want to have to reach behind things to figure out where the button is.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is probably a you know, once every day sort of situation. So it really means twice every day, because like if there's like a time where I'll be using my work computer all day and then I want to switch over to do some home stuff or whatever on my home Mac. So there's that time I switch. And then maybe if I wake up in the morning, now I got to switch everything back again. Mm-hmm. And so the less sort of manual configuration you're doing every time, the better.
Yeah, yeah. So it would be, I need to do some more looking, and if I run across it, I'll send it your way. But either something that does like the full on power delivery, that would be amazing. Or it would be really cool if it was built into the display. I was watching some CES coverage. I don't know if you follow, what's his name on YouTube? And I'm not going to get it. But he has dispatches from CES, and I was watching those, and one of them he mentioned, I think it's an HP display, so it's not an Apple display, which is what I would be hoping for, but it kind of had that built in where it had this KVM switch that you could route everything through, including the power delivery. So it was just all built into the monitor. It's like, man, Apple, please take a lesson from this one.
Yeah, I've only been paying attention to CES through listening to the Verge's podcast. Mm-hmm. They're a fun listen, and they have a pretty good sense of humor about the things that they're seeing. But they're also like into it, you know, so they're like really geeky about it. And at the same time, sometimes, you're talking about a refrigerator with a giant screen on it that wants to bake AI into it for some reason. And so that's kind of funny to listen to, but that's always been one of those conferences that I'm happy not to go to, but I do like a very high level, just like, oh yeah, they're still doing crazy things with TVs this year too. And then every once in a while you'll hear about something like super interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Like transparent TVs and all these other things. It's like, I guess I see it's fun that you can make it look like an aquarium. It will never have any practical purpose in my house. But for anyone who likes transparent TVs, no knock on you.
So I haven't even seen those yet. I have only heard them described in podcast form. So, it's funny, until you mentioned it, now I'm kind of vaguely interested in seeing what it is. But before just listening to it, I mean, for one, we don't really have a TV in our house. So like, that's a thing that I doubt a transparency is the reason, the one thing we were waiting for.
This was the killer feature.
We're more likely to go the projector route, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know, like, that's not like a burning need for me personally, but I guess I'll have a look at what these transparent TVs look like sometime soon, just so I know.
Yeah. Well, I think, this one was, I forget which one it was, and they're well outside the scope of my budget, but most of them have been like more thin panels, and this one was more like it stood out from the wall and was like literally the shape of an aquarium. And one of the examples was putting fish on the display and you could see right through it. It's like, that's cool. I'd rather have real fish, but it's kind of funny, some of the stuff that comes up with CES. So I also watched iFixit they were in part of it. They have, there was this video on YouTube, the worst of CES, and it's like worst of for repairability, worst of for privacy. I'll have to see if I can find the link in my history, because that was an interesting one to see which ones they picked. And it's always interesting just to see what's going on over there. I was actually kind of surprised that they were back, but they did have some keyboards that I was looking at going, it's about time for me to replace my main typing keyboard. I've had this one forever, and it's like they had a few interesting ones there. But
Cool. Worth checking out. Yeah, I'm a ride or die Apple Bluetooth keyboard and trackpad thing forever. And so I'm not sure what it would take to get me to change these things. But I respect the nerdery of folks who are really into their keyboards. It's just not something that I've never quite caught that itch.
Well, yes. And if Apple would do something, if Apple would do a trackpad or not like a trackball, I would be all over it. And if they would do an ergonomic keyboard, I have a Logitech ergonomic, but I've used it so much that literally the keys, the lettering is coming off the keys, which normally is not a big deal until I look at the keyboard and go, which letter is where? But it also has problems with Bluetooth. So like it randomly cuts off during the day, which ticks me off because I'll be in the middle of a word and it's like nothing is happening. So it's hitting its age, but I also have a Logitech trackball that you can pry from my dead hands because this thing is the only way that I survive working on a computer for long periods of time without clobbering my wrists.
That thing is huge. It's like it looks like a one of those bear claw donuts or something.
It's a
mouse and a trackball?
Well, it's not a mouse even, so it doesn't move on the desk. It stays in one spot, and then it has the little trackball on one side and then the mouse-shaped buttons. And then it angles up for like ergonomics if you need to have it tilted. But it makes it so easy to slide across the screen and stuff. The only thing that it's bad at is pinch and zoom gestures, which is why I might almost still have to have a trackpad somewhere on my desk, or a touchpad on my desk. But when this thing dies, I will immediately go buy another one.
Man, this has been such a strange week because it's the second time that the concept of a trackball has come up in one of my conversations. And I got to tell you, that's not something I ever spend time talking about. The only way, every time I hear someone say trackball, all I can say is like, that sounds like I'm playing Centipede all day. And I don't mean that in a good way. Like I couldn't. And so again, respect to everyone's preferred input devices. But for me, trackball is decidedly not it.
I can totally understand why. And especially on some of the trackballs, it took me a while before I found out that this one was one that I could live with. Because some of the other ones out there are just horrible.
Fair enough. Well, so there we have it. We've kind of kicked off the year with some fun things in our office, a little nerdery about CES, and even thinking through our input peripherals, which is fun. You definitely have a more adventurous setup than I do, but all well and good. We want to look to the future just a little bit about not what we did, throughout the new year and all of that, but kind of what we think we're going to do in 2024. I don't know if you're like a big resolution person. I'll tell you, I'm really not. Like, I kind of tend to start out thinking through certain types of things I want to look into, but I always give myself permission to follow other things unless it's like really, you know, something really important in my life that I know I want to do this year. But it tends not to be a resolution per se. Before we jump into any of that, kind of like what we want to think about or learn this year, what's your stance on doing resolutions?
I think I did resolutions maybe seriously 1 year, promptly broke all of them, and have never bothered to do them since. I'm kind of the same way. Number one, like, tech evolves so quickly that like in 6 months' time, even the stuff that we have like on the list of things I want to learn that we're going to talk about here soon, my investment in some of those things may be in an entirely different direction. So it's like, I want to give myself that kind of permission. And I kind of also want to keep it more higher level, if that makes sense, like a little bit more freedom of movement, so to speak. So like more like I want to do like things around topics or maybe pushing myself a little in terms of learning something new, but it doesn't have to be that specifically one thing. If there's, you know, it's more like the journey on that you take on going. And if I get, if my attention gets taken by something else, that's not the end of the world either. So like, I try to give myself permission. It's not a failure if I don't completely learn that one thing or meet that particular goal. if I still learned and grew through the process. So that's kind of how I approach it.
Yeah. I think we're similar in that way then. So that having been said, we're going to talk through a number of different things about, like, at least like what's currently on our radar and what we might be getting into in 2024. So I'm going to hand the mic off to you first, and I want to hear like what's first on your list, and maybe we kind of kick this back and forth as we've done on a few episodes before.
That sounds great. So the first one is I have threatened this for a few years and never found the time to do it or got the purchase, but I'm starting learning FPGA development. So this is very different than regular programming. You're thinking more in the realm of hardware, and the tool chain is absolutely kind of nuts to someone who's just familiar with software. But I bought this cute little kit board called, let's see if I can get it to come off, called the Alkriti AU. I think I'm saying that right. Alcatri. They have various different boards. This is running a, if I can read it, Artix 7 FPGA core. And then it came with a few other boards, some input output boards. So like I have little LEDs and some switches and stuff that I can play with. And so I finally pulled the trigger on that. The board was not that terribly expensive. Which is partly what convinced me to go get it. And it had a decent amount of storage is not quite the right word, but like a decent number of logic gates or LUTs is what they call them. And so it came with some built onboard RAM as well that you could interface with. And so I grabbed this up from SparkFun and hooked it up just before I came back to work. So I haven't had a whole lot of time to play with it in addition, but I got enough to where I had created a Windows 11 virtual machine because this does not work on Mac OS. I got Xilinx Vivado, which is the name of the software you have to kind of compile, but that's not really the right word for hardware, your designs and put it on there. And so I got the whole tool chain validated and working. I can actually take an example, not something I've built myself yet, but an example, run it through that, get it running on the device, and it works. But my goal with this is to, so in the past, we've mentioned on the podcast a few times too, I have this kind of like fantasy faux retro computer that never existed, but I had a JavaScript version of it. It's always been kind of part of my, something that I thought would be fun is to try and get that onto real hardware and understand the challenges there. And that requires a different kind of mindset. So that means building up a hardware CPU and a hardware display device. And how do you do input and output and all of that jazz? I think maybe we've talked a little bit about like NAND to Tetris or something like that at some point.
Yeah.
But kind of along the same lines, except instead of building it out of just straight breadboard circuits, it's on a little board with a hardware description language that looks suspiciously like a programming language, but it's not. It just describes the behavior of all the wires. And so I thought it would be fun to try and figure that out in the little spare time I have. It also got me into trying to remember what all the stuff I had done in RetroPeter and how I had designed it and how much that's going to make my life difficult when I try to convert this to hardware. Because hardware and JavaScript are two very different things.
understatement of the year, but totally. I'm interested in like just even the name, right? So FPGA, I found myself asking ChatGPT what that even stands for, and it mm-hmm. says it's called Field Programmable Gate Array, where the concept of field programmable means it's like something that can be programmed or configured by the customer or designer after manufacturing. So like, in other words, all the things you just described, you can do that because it is field programmable. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty interesting. I got to say, like, this is a new concept for me.
It is. I mean, I've heard of FPGAs a lot in, like, in terms of emulation isn't quite the right word, but, you know, if you've done any retro hardware, I can't even think of their names at the moment, but, like, there's a Mr. FPGA that has a lot of cores, or what they call are cores. And so you can have hardware emulation of, like, an Atari or some other Nintendo console or what have you. And so I've known that these have existed for a while. And then it's like, I've been curious to try it. And what finally got me over was, one, the price of this board was not terribly expensive, and it was actually in stock. Sometimes these boards are hard to get in stock. And they, Alcatree, it's hard for me to say the brand name. So apologies if I'm missaying it. They actually have a version of the hardware description language. So hardware description language is usually Verilog or VHDL, I think. And Alcatree have gone and made a layer on top of it that is supposed to make it a little bit easier for people new to this to learn. We'll find out how true that is. But they even had an example of, oh, here's a basic CPU. And naive me said, well, then it'll be fairly simple to do. And then as I remembered everything that I was doing with RetroPewter, it's like, no, it will not be that simple. But I figured it would be a good start to go down that journey. And it's been a while since I've thought about things like logic and circuits and stuff like that since college days. I remember it being fun at the time. We'll see how much this holds true as I go through it. So far, the most challenging aspect is that the tool chains required to make these work do not work on Mac, or Mac OS, I should say. So Vivado is Linux or Windows. And so I have it actually running on a Windows VM on my MacBook just to get it running. But then it doesn't have the right drivers because it's Windows on ARM. Oddly enough, there is another little piece of software that once you get all the compilation done, you can run that part on Mac OS and it will transmit it to the board. But just today I was actually trying to get all this to work on a Linux VM and see if I could skip that step, and realizing that the Linux on, or at least the one I chose on Linux, is horribly unstable on Mac OS right now. So, that's my current discovery, is like how painful the tool chain is on anything but a regular Windows machine.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. The sheer, like, chain of tools thing is something that, like, hits pretty close to home, actually, for one of my next things that I'm going to be playing around with more this year, and indeed started playing around with it today, actually. So I recently came across, and may have mentioned on one of our last episodes, this thing called a Makey Makey. And you can go on and order these wherever. I can't remember if I ordered these on Amazon or if I got them straight from the website, but you can do both. Mm-hmm. So if you go to makeymakey.com, they have a little shop there you can order. So this concept of a Makey Makey is basically like this little board that you plug in to your computer, and it serves as an input device. So it really, like, you know, by default, the input device maps to different keys on your keyboard. So I think, like,
cool.
Yeah. So it'll look like something when you first get it out. It's like, oh, this is a game controller. Well, that's just kind of how they decided to represent it. But, like, you know, it has four arrows and a D-shaped pad, and then one quote unquote button that maps to space, and one that maps, like, the space bar, and one that maps to a mouse click. So there's a lot more, you know, you can remap those if you want, but also on the back of the Makey Makey, there's little inputs for, like, you know, WASD, whatever, all the typical keyboard buttons. So the whole idea behind this thing is it's kind of just like you can turn everyday objects into little input devices. So my daughter, who just turned 7, and I we got it out today, and first thing you do is plug it into the computer. And then you take some alligator clips, one for these little pincher things, and what you put it into, like, their first project is like, you're going to make congas, like conga drums.
Mm-hmm.
So you plug one alligator clip into one button on the Makey Makey, and then another alligator clip into another. Those two in turn connect to whatever everyday object you might want to connect with. But the canonical example, the hello world for Makey Makey, is connecting it to bananas. So we had already bought bananas explicitly for this purpose. So we had some bananas. We connected each one of those alligator clips into two different bananas. And then there's one more alligator clip that you need to connect to yourself for Earth and to complete the circuit. So it kind of runs through you. And then once you have their little website open, that is just like a little web app that shows some bongos or congas or whatever. And once you tap on those bananas, you're now playing conga drums.
Oh, that's hilarious.
That's kind of the hello world of it. And then from there, we made like a little, they have another example. It's like, okay, now you're going to use five bananas and play a little mini keyboard in one of their web apps. So we did that. They had another thing, like in the box, it has a few like example, like here's some stuff to get started with. So, in terms of projects, one of the projects we did was like design your own guitar on cardboard, and then we'll show you how to hook it up so you can like play guitar sounds. Well, the thing is, we had just thrown away all the cardboard for today or put it into recycling. And my daughter was very sad about this at first, but then I reminded her, it's like, babe, you have a ukulele.
Oh.
So what we actually ended up doing instead was we set this thing up to where basically, instead of doing all this on cardboard, we could put the Earth tinfoil on the neck of the guitar or the ukulele, and then put tinfoil around each one of the strings. And now you're connecting all of this stuff back to the Makey Makey. And then again, they have a webpage you can go to that will interpret those inputs. I think these were the ones that were mapped to different letters on the keyboard, but then you're playing like little rock sounds. So this is like, compared to awesome. Your like super deep down in the weeds, like hardware thing, like this is like the highest level of high levels. It's basically we're pretending, we're faking we're keys on a keyboard so that we can trigger silly things inside of a browser window. And the final example that we did from the instruction set was, it doesn't all have to be instruments, right? So one mm-hmm. thing we did was you can take one alligator clip and put it into Earth, another mm-hmm. alligator clip and put it into the click button. And then you have two people, each one holds the alligator clip. And then the idea is you put your mouse, have it hover right over a video stop start thing button. So I did this with like some I just opened up iPhoto or Apple Photos or whatever, and found a video of my daughter running around like a maniac in the snow the other day. And so we could do like fist bumps, and it would just basically pause play the movie. And it's so silly, right? But we had like the best time. That might have been the one we played with the longest, because we just kept picking different videos. But anyways, that's like, those are all like the hello world, if you mm-hmm. will, for the Makey Makey. And then after that, like, I'm sure we'll come up with other ideas later on, but I think there's probably something really interesting in here, because you can imagine, like, if you can trigger mouse clicks or keyboard buttons or whatever, yeah. then sky's the limit. I have a GitHub repo that I made a number of years ago that is like drum pads recorded in the bamboo forest behind my wife's parents' house in southern Japan. So I went through, this is when I was waiting on my daughter to be born. So this is a long time ago now, 7 years ago, in fact. So I go behind the house, and I had one of those, like a little Zoom type recorder, and just recorded sounds inside of the bamboo forest, took those back, and then built a little web app that was just like, it looked like a kind of like an NPC style, you know, 4x4 grid where you're going to trigger some sounds, and then just mapped all of that into something in a UI. So now I want to see, I'm dusting that repo back off 7 years later to see if she and I, you know, can plug this into the Makey Makey and do some fun things with it.
Oh, that sounds so fun. Once you have whatever you can control with input, that gives you all sorts of potential fun things that you can do. I was worried a little worried that if it wasn't doing it with actual like keyboard and mouse, like maybe it was having to do it over USB. Like I know maybe Chrome does web USB, but I know Safari doesn't. So like that's where you can start to get into some challenges there in terms of like back to the tool chain. But simulating a keyboard and mouse nicely sidesteps a lot of that.
I wonder too if we can get the Makey Makey to communicate over MIDI.
Ooh, because that'd be fun.
Browsers, as far as I know, all browsers at this point would support Web MIDI. Web MIDI, I remember making a project with it. Actually, that's the photo on my LinkedIn page. I haven't updated it in eight years at this point, or whatever. Whenever that was, like 2015. But like I was using Web MIDI with some friends at a time to build like a browser-based drum machine, and that was still when you needed a special flag in Chrome to get Web MIDI.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't long after that it went GA in Chrome. I kind of imagine most of the browsers must have picked it up, but you never know.
Yeah, now that would be really, really cool as control all sorts of synths and other interesting sounds on that. I think it's really cool that you can that she's interested in this, and you can kind of expose, like there's really good ways to expose kids to these ideas of input isn't just a key on a keyboard. It is like this physical connection of a closing of a circuit and how all of this stuff works. And it's much more hands-on and maybe hopefully interesting. But I feel like it's super cool that these things exist.
Yeah. I mean, she's been banging down my door trying to, once she knew that the Makey Makey had arrived, because it's been here for a few weeks. I just hadn't had an afternoon where we could sit and do this. And today was the day. So yeah, she seems to be super interested in it. And, as long as she is, I'm down to do it with her. And at the same time, there are going to be moments where I can just like grab it and play with it. I think one of the things I saw today in the guitar example that they have is what you end up doing is going to their website and triggering like a little Scratch program through the, like, the, yeah. So
nice.
It's Scratch, right? Which means if you can do it with Scratch, you'd probably do it with any sort of programmable environment at that point. So I didn't dig into how the software side of it was working, because this wasn't the day for that. But that indicates there's some a deeper end of the pool to swim in, which sounds like it'll be pretty fun.
Ooh, that's exciting. Maybe a future podcast episode.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. So this next thing you have on your list, I'm super interested, because I don't know why I'm as interested as I am, but I need to know more about this. So what do you got next?
So next on my list is 3D printing. So I have not for it's always been kind of interesting, a little bit curious, that, you know, cool that it exists, but I haven't ever actually thought about actually getting one. And then I started doing a little bit of research, and it's like, okay, the 3D printers aren't horribly expensive. They can be, but like there are some within the realm of, it's not the worst thing in the world if this does not work out, or if you decide that, you know, 3D printing isn't for you. And so it's come up a few times, and then my dad, oddly enough, was also interested in it, and so was my mom. And so like one day we were just even sitting watching a few videos on YouTube about beginners and 3D printing and the stuff you need to know, and it's a rabbit hole, is what I can understand. But my current challenges is just, where do I put a 3D printer? And where do I put a 3D printer that the cats won't clobber? So, because I can't imagine that a cat coming along in the middle of a 3D print would be a good thing. But I've, at first, is like, I really wouldn't have anything for to use a 3D printer for. And then I started thinking about it. It's like, even just the FPGA that I just got, like it's basic, it's raw boards. So there is actually a model online where you could do a 3D print and print a case for it, or
enclosures.
All these things, or like little tools. And it kind of has started to sing a siren song. It's like, maybe I should hop into this a little bit, start small. So I'm not sure which one I'm going, which 3D printer I might grab. But there's a couple of smaller ones on the market, just to at least, you know, that they say are good for beginners. I think Bamboo is maybe the name of the company. Anyone who has their feet into 3D printers, I'm sure will have lots of ideas, but that's kind of crossed my mind, is like, it's within the realm of affordability. It's not the worst loss if it doesn't get used a whole lot. But I could imagine some decent stuff. Like I've even got a few things of, because in my bedroom, I have an Xbox console. I have my Nintendo Switch. I have my Steam Deck. I would like to be able to get a dock for. Now you're looking at three controllers or what have you. It's like, there are models for printing controller stands. And it's, you know, suddenly all those ideas have come to mind. It's like, maybe, just maybe, I will test the waters with 3D printing.
It's interesting that's not the thing I thought you were about to talk about, but the funny part is like, but it doesn't matter. Like that's interesting, because like, it's funny how much we seem to be in sync on some of these things. This was the moment over the holidays where I finally had that moment where I thought, you know, as we were taking everything out of the house and cleaning it all and whatnot, where I realized I might actually get some benefit out of owning a 3D printer, because sometimes there are moments where I'm like, if this one little thing existed, I could do exactly the thing that I want to do. And then the thing I hate most about shopping is when I know exactly what I want, which is frequent. So then you have to go find who made the thing, who read your mind. And so like, there are like little things where, you know, 3D printer wouldn't solve all of those problems, but it would make a decent dent in some of those things.
Yes. Yes. It has definitely, and it feels like it's achievable. Like I know there was a, the first time I was exposed to some 3D printing was, it was actually one of the WeConnect the Dots, events that I helped teach at. This would have been like 6 years ago, and they had a 3D printer, but it was like one of these kit ones where you had to build it all up yourself, and it looked cool and exciting, but it was big, and I don't have time to put together a whole lot of kits. I say this as I'm learning FPGA development, but so recognizing the irony there. The newer, it seems like you can now get ones where they're nicely bundled, or like they're all together. They don't require a lot of construction, and they're not. Some of them are really large if you need to do like big prints, but like I would never need a big print. So there's some of them that are small enough where it's like, I could maybe imagine finding a corner of the office or of the basement where this could live, as long as I can keep the cats away from it. But yeah.
I'm looking at the Wirecutter article for the best 3D printer for 2024. They write, it looks like it was updated at the beginning of November in 2023, but that's how they're framing it, is these are the ones for 2024. And indeed, the top pick is the Bamboo. They spell it B-A-M-B-U, apparently. Mm-hmm. So there's a Bamboo Lab P1P. They call it the best 3D printer. I haven't read through this at all, obviously, because I just pulled it up. But I don't know, $600. I can't tell if in my mind that is more expensive or less expensive than I was expecting. But they've come. There was a time where I feel like they were all like north of $1,000, weren't they?
Oh, easy, yeah. And they have ones cheaper than that one I've seen. Is like some of them down to, in fact, one of them on this list is like $200. It's not enclosed, if I remember right. So there's ones even cheaper than that. And it's like, okay. Now, realizing that there's the one-off cost, and then there's the cost of all the, what do they call it, the filament or the printing material that goes into it. So as you print, that's going to take more expense. But Yeah, for something that's nicely enclosed. And I think I would have to have something enclosed because both of our cats would not care one whip stitch if they tried to walk and bumped it and destroyed a print. And I want something that is like kind of set and forget. Like I could send the print job to it and maybe I learn how to make good prints, but I don't have to worry about all the rest of like how did I put it together right? And is it my fault or is it the machine's fault where these are all kind of already pre-assembled and easy to put together?
This is super cool. Yeah, I'm not sure if this is the year for me on this, but it's like super tempting. It is super tempting. And I can already think of a handful of like small projects of things that I would be making with it. So,
Oh, yes.
Surprisingly, there's a use case in my house. But yeah, the footprint is definitely a question. Yeah,
that's the hard part. And, you know, all the would I have because you can kit these out to like the nth degree. I was digging into this is like, I mean, you could print just with a single kind of filament, or you have these multicolor holders where you could have the same printer printing off of 4, 8, and 16 different filaments. It's like that starts to become bigger than I had in mind, but it's kind of crazy how deep this rabbit hole goes.
Well, that sounds fun. And if you do end up going down that rabbit hole, we should talk about it. I want to live vicariously through you and potentially then benefit from whatever knowledge you gain as you try that. Because it's a totally new world for me and something that seems like it could be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So next up on my list is I'm just going to bucket a handful of things together and put it under the category of coding.
Yes.
So there's a few things on my list of stuff that are just sort of, let me say, like maybe not coding per se, but more like web app just in general. Dino, I feel like this is the year I want to start noodling around with it. Mm-hmm. We have had the odd customer question at Nihilus about Dino here and there. And so that makes me wonder, because it's a technology that has been on my radar since it started. At the same time, it's not something I encounter in the wild unless I'm on Hacker News. Mm-hmm. So
yes,
I think
very true.
Yeah. So there's something in there that I want to start like getting my hands on a bit. We had recently a question about compatibility of our Node SDK or Node.js SDK with Dino.
Oh yeah.
And that's when I think about that, I'm like, yeah, sure. That would make sense that could be possible, but I have some baseline learning to do before I would even know how to like go try that myself. So that's one. Another is just in general, sort of like new to me, app frameworks or bootstrapping tools. So, you know, Create React App is apparently a thing of the past. And so, you know, there's all these other bootstrapping tools that are out there.
There's so many of them. It's hard for me to keep track of what's going on in that world.
It's overwhelming, to be honest, and they change so often. But then there are times where I'm like, you know, I'd like to kind of do a reset of how I, you know, if I want to build a quick web app, like what are the things I'm going to pull off the shelf? So if you sort of like high level areas would be something like, do I use Vite or do I use Next.js? Or what about Remix, which is something I noodled around with for half a second last year. But I think maybe I need to give one of these things a deeper try after I kind of decide which ones in my realm of things I want to play around with. So we'll see where that goes. Also, static site generators, SSGs, right? So there's a number of them out there I want to get my hands on and start playing with just to see. The idea, of course, again, is if I want to make a quick web app, I want to just have some tools at my disposal. And there is something there that feels a bit like I can certainly do that. But at the same time, the tool set has certainly shifted in terms of like what people actually use today. And so I want to see if I can kind of pick a few and have those be like my next go-tos.
And I'm going to be really curious about what you discover there, because there's been a few some ancient, like my mom had an old music website, and I was digging through it the other day. It's like, you know, this would be kind of fun to, you know, modernize a bit, because I mean, half of it doesn't work anymore because we haven't kept it up to date. Technology wise, like it still talks about Flash and stuff. But it's like, okay, how would, it's not a simple website. Maybe you could do something like that with Wix, but that's not really what Wix is targeted for. I mean, this is kind of like a mix of database slash showing, you know, where you'd have some custom visualizations of what you're looking at. It feels like a static site generator slash one of these frameworks might be a good avenue to explore on that. So I'm going to be very curious how all that works out for you.
Yeah. And that's the whole thing is like, you know, tools like Wix or Squarespace or any of that stuff, like they have their time and their place. We're using, as I've mentioned before on this podcast, like, you know, for my wife's business, we use Wix and mm-hmm. it's fantastic for what we need. But for me, building like an odd web app here and there, just to put something in prod and play around with it kind of thing, like that's something that I'm not sure I would want to. It's almost like too much to go with one of those kind of like app or website generators, like the sort of off the shelf commercial mm-hmm. ones. Instead, I'd like to have like my own preferred go-to stack for building things that I want to play around with.
Yeah. Yeah, and that affords you both some degree of flexibility. And if there's things you want to do that maybe Wix or one of these others isn't, you know, well suited for, but also just keeps you up to date in terms of what's going on out there.
Yeah. And speaking of what's going on out there, we talked a lot in past shows about Open API, you know, and I'm a huge fan. At the same time, there are other paradigms for building APIs, right? So, for example, one that has had a lot of favor over the last number of years is GraphQL. Mm-hmm. And that one's interesting. I suppose it's not really like I can use it and will use it if it's something that's put in front of me. But at the same time, there's something about it that just, I don't know, I don't get super hyped about it the way some folks might. And, you know, it's just maybe it's my own way of thinking about these kind of things is a little, I don't know, maybe it's just trapped in like REST API world or something. So who knows? But there is something that I keep hearing more and more about recently, which is called async API. And I want to noodle around with that just a bit. So the idea being that like async API is, I suppose, a standard and a bunch of open source tools that let you build things that are like event driven architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is exactly what it is, but yeah, I'll give you kind of what I think it is before I've gotten into it. So, you know, for example, in REST API land, if you can't get an immediate response, look, you're kind of out of luck. The only other thing that you can do,
right,
like, in terms of like you've asked something for something to happen that's going to take a long time or maybe happen at some point in the future, the only way for you to then find out if that ever happened is to go polling. And so the industry's answer to this has been webhooks, which is really mm-hmm. cool, right? Because it's the don't call us, we'll call you method. Don't poll us, you know? So eventually, like you put, when you're going to set up a webhook, the idea is you tell the API that you are interacting with, like, okay, when this thing happens in the future, I want to know about it. Call this endpoint on my server. And
right.
then, you know, from there, maybe there's a handshake or who knows, and you'll get what you need. So that's how a lot of this stuff happens today. But I think that async API is a standard for looking at how to solve this problem in a different way. That is my high level understanding of it, not having touched it yet. But this is something that feels like pretty interesting to me personally, and probably something I want to play around with this year.
That sounds interesting, because I could definitely imagine, like, REST is great for short, maybe not instantaneous, but instantaneous enough actions where it doesn't take a long time to get the result. Like, if you had, let's say, a back-end service that was querying an AI model or doing video processing where it might take a long time before you get the end results, like having to go through all the effort of setting up a webhook and having your back end set ready for it. And that's assuming that that other service even takes care of having or can call you back in the first place. Like, that's a lot of work. If there's an easier way to do that, that sounds really interesting.
And one of the common complaints with webhooks that I've, or one of the failure modes, I suppose, that I've seen in the past is like companies that offer webhook interaction sometimes will, you know, be a little too friendly or eager to update you to the point where like you can get DDoSed by right? the API you're trying to get updates from. And I mean, I've seen that in multiple situations in the past. And so I think like, it's just an area where like suddenly you're building almost like this sort of sidecar. I mean, it's a bad way to put it, but like it's sort of like off to the side, sort of like, here's how we're going to handle this particular situation. So
yeah.
I'm assuming based on the name alone that like async API is looking to like figure out a good way to do this. And preferably if it's happening all within sort of the same specification, that, you know, there's less, I don't know, such chances to get taken advantage of if you're like someone who wants to receive things via webhooks. And like you said, like you may not have your application's infrastructure set up for that yet.
Right.
So even if the company you're trying to integrate with doesn't DDoS you, like there's a lot of things you got to think about in terms of like, well, now here's a new sort of thing to defend because now I've opened up an endpoint on my site.
Right. Yeah. All the security implications that comes with. Oh, that's going to be interesting. I'll be very curious what you discover in that realm.
Cool. All right. So I think the next thing on your list is the thing I was talking about earlier, but let's surprise me. Let's find out.
Okay. So the next one on my list kind of relates, well, it's technical, so or technology, so it relates kind of maybe into the next one even, but LaTeX. Is apparently the way you say this.
Did not know, but that is the thing that I was expecting you to talk about. I didn't know you call it LaTeX. Interesting.
I didn't either until I was Googling around and I came across this one website. Maybe it's a wiki article or something like that. Anyway, saying pronounced this way or that way. And one of them was LaTeX. I forget what the other one was. And then it said never LaTeX. And it's like, okay, well, that's all I've ever pronounced it as. So apologies. I'll say LaTeX from now on. I have dabbled in the past, usually only in like if you ever needed to represent like a mathematic equation in, say, like a static site generator. Maybe it has a plugin that generates math equations. And so I've dabbled with it in a little bit. And it's always looked like this weird, esoteric, unparsable thing, kind of like back in the day when I was first being exposed to like Perl and these, you know, very terse languages which have a lot of power, but then it's like, oh, I can't read that. And I don't know what drove me to it, but it's partly in relationship to all of the stuff I'm doing with FPGA and RetroPewter. And I was like, well, wouldn't it be kind of nice just to have because if I'm going to figure out how to build a CPU, I'm going to need to build up some technical docs of how this thing works. And I was thinking, well, I could do it in Markdown. Markdown's really not suited for a lot of like diagrams and things like that. I mean, there are ways of doing it, but like LaTeX has lots of ways of building diagrams in it. It generates nice PDFs. Markdown, you're usually going to a browser and then hoping that it can convert to a PDF in a decent manner. Lots of reasons. And then I considered, well, maybe I do this in Word or something else. And it's like, no, you know what? There's a thing out there that it's been on the edge of my consciousness. I've seen it used a lot. Let me just have a go at it. It's different. It is not Markdown by any stretch of the imagination. It's not even, I wouldn't even compare it to anything like HTML or whatnot. It takes a little bit of getting used to because there's all these backslashes and curly braces. And I say this coming from JavaScript, a programming language that uses curly braces all over. They are all over in LaTeX documents. But it's kind of fun in a weird way. Because you immediately, if you're doing anything more than a standard document where it's just like paragraph and chapters and sections, what I've been trying to do is build up some tables and some visualizations and things like that. You immediately get into where you need to add additional packages. And so there is this whole ecosystem around LaTeX that has people contributing modules like to do colorful boxes. So like if you want to have like call outs for notes and warnings and all of these things, there's a package that has infinite customization on what these things look like. Or if you want to have a table that can break across multiple pages and have nice smart formatting in terms of determining column width and all of this stuff, someone has been nice enough to build a package that does that, and it's infinitely customizable. Same thing with charting and visualizations. And there's this whole kind of ecosystem out there that I didn't know anything about, which is kind of cool. And you're operating on words and tokens, and you're generating visual printable output, which is a little bit different than how we normally think about like web development, where you're going out to HTML and you're putting something onto the screen. And yeah, you could turn it to PDF or turn it to something print, but this is print first. And so it's a little bit different way of thinking about things. But what kind of got me into it and what appealed to me was this notion of references. So you can have anywhere in your LaTeX document, here's a table, or here's a code listing, or here is a diagram. And I can easily reference that anywhere else in my document. And LaTeX will be the one that figures out on page 8, figure 1.2.1 or whatever. And as long as you have the references linked, it takes care of, you know, what page was that on? What section was that in? What was the caption that it was when I named it? All of those kinds of things. Plus it can generate indexes and tables of contents and stuff that you could do in some of these other tools if they were built to do it, or you could write code to do it too in JavaScript or whatnot. But it's kind of comes mostly for free if you know how to do it in LaTeX. So I don't know. I thought it was kind of fun, and I found a Mac app that kind of simplifies. Well, I won't say simplifies. It makes the process of learning this a little bit easier because one of the challenges I've always had is usually it's you're editing your LaTeX document in one editor, and then you're having to generate, you're typesetting it and previewing it in something else. So you have a long iteration cycle between what you know. It's like writing some code and then not running it and for a few statements. And then you have a bug and you're going, what did I break? All of that stuff. But this Mac app called Textifier, and I'll put a link in the show notes. It used to be known under a different name. It's not a free Mac app. I think it's $40 paid. I'm still in the trial period. But what's nice about it is you can have your LaTeX document and then the result live as you type. So like a markdown previewer or whatnot, but this is for LaTeX. And it means that you get immediate feedback if what you're doing is working, which is immensely valuable to me. And so I don't know, this was a weird rabbit hole for me to go down, but it's kind of fun. It's also kind of frustrating sometimes because you'll end up in these error messages saying, because it tries to be helpful, kind of like HTML or JavaScript will be like automatic semicolon insertion, right? Where it's like, oh, you're missing a semicolon. Here, let me fix that for you. Apparently LaTeX will do that sometimes too. And so you end up getting error messages down further down the road. And it's like, well, why'd you do that? Oh, it's because you were trying to be helpful above. And so debugging your document, which is not something I ever thought I ever would say, but debugging your document is a thing. And so you have to get used to it a little bit, but having that visual side by side is really nice. And so, yeah, it takes care of the pain of typesetting, and I'm finding it oddly enjoyable.
Okay. Yeah, I was trying to find just like an example of what does this stuff even look like? And I don't know if this is modern LaTeX or not, but it's on a Stanford server. And it shows just like an example document where I guess there's front matter at the top. It's all like backslash document class. And then it shows like the font size.
Yeah.
And I don't know what all this is, but then like, instead of having like a single hashtag or a like a pound sign for your H1 heading, it does like a, you can do backslash section asterisks, and then in curly brackets put the name of the section. Mm-hmm. So there's section and then subsection under that. And then there's all this craziness that you can do like a little tree structure or whatever. And that's the part where like you can see the flexibility and the power, but also there'd be a lot of learning in order to figure out how to do this.
Yeah. But what's cool, what I think is interesting, and I don't know if I'll ever get here because I'm doing this purely from trying to typeset some documentation for myself. But it is an extensible language. So you can like you write all these packages in its language. So you're kind of building your document out of code in some ways. You can do that. But it's also got these macro capabilities. So like if you find yourself typing this certain phrase a lot, or you need this certain kind of shape a lot, you can say, I'm not going to have to, you know, repeat that 10 times. I'll create a new command for it and name it. And then anywhere I use it, then I get that for, you know, just a few keystrokes. Like it's really kind of, it's super powerful, and I haven't even begun to scratch the surface. I can understand, or I can kind of see why now it gets used as much as it does, especially in like more science journals and publishing technical publications and things, because there is so much power in it, and also so much ways it can go horribly wrong, I imagine, in terms of, you know, packages fighting with each other. But it's super fun in an odd, satisfying way. I find it kind of fun to try and figure out how do I get my vision across in a new language. That, I mean, it'd be one thing on HTML. If I need to build a table, I'll use a table element and I'll style it with some CSS. And here there is no CSS. It's all very new territory.
Yeah, I see. For the extensibility, if you want to pull in something, there's like a, I don't know if backslash is like a command or what, but like there's a use package thing, and then you can pull in the name of the package you're going to use. Does that mean, is there like a NPM for LaTeX? Where do you find all these packages?
There is, one, you can host these packages in all sorts of places. So like a lot of them I've come across are on like GitHub. People make them available there. So you can have like your own, you can install them like you would like cloning a GitHub repo. Texifier is kind of nice in that it comes with a repository manager that has a lot of packages bundled together, and you can check a box and have it download them for you. So kind of not quite like an NPM, but close. But you're depending upon Texifier curating those packages. Word of warning, if you do, there is one package that is additional fonts, which is nice to have if you want to have more than just the standard LaTeX Times New Roman. I like having sans serif for my technical body font. That thing downloads a tremendous amount of data because it like downloads just about every open source free font out there. It's a very large bundle. So FYI on that one. But like, there are I forget the name of it. I'll have to see if I can put it in the show notes. There is like this kind of standard repository out there where a lot of these things live, and there's readmes and there's PDFs that tell you how to use them because you're doing print. So the examples are in the PDF file. And so, yeah, there's a lot of those things kind of like NPM, but for text.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. This is a world that LaTeX seems to appear on Hacker News just constantly. And it's been something that I'll click through a link and I'm like, yeah, these folks are talking about something and I don't know what that is. And I knew that this was some sort of like dark document markup thing. And it seemed to be filling a niche that is not something that I felt like I had. But this is really interesting to get a chance to kind of look under the hood just a little bit to see what this is all about.
Yeah. It's very it's a very different world. And I'm sure I am writing horrible LaTeX because I'm figuring things out as I go. And the stack, there's a LaTeX Stack Overflow and various other things online that is proving immensely valuable as to like how do I rotate one page to be landscape? Because I might have a table that's super wide. There's a package for that, it turns out. And but it's been fun trying to get it to do what I want it to do, but also then understand it's a typesetter. It's going to have opinions about how the text should look too. And that's part of the point of using it, is you don't have to worry about every little bit of minutia when it comes to typesetting your text. The idea is to let the typesetter do what it thinks is best. And then the references help you. You don't have to know what page something is on. If it puts it on page 10, because that's where the layout worked, all your references update. So it's both fun in terms of learning, but also fun in like, you're not supposed to have to worry about every pixel on the page, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you remember we did an episode last year on Mermaid.js?
Yes.
So would this, is this just like a, like where Mermaid would be like probably a easier way in? Is this just like the deep end of the pool where it's going to do what Mermaid does plus 1,000 other things? Like, would you be able to do what you do in Mermaid.js with LaTeX?
Yes. And you'd probably have a package for it. There's probably, I'm trying to remember, I think some of the syntax may be inspired by that, if I remember right. But there is like a package where you can get like diagramming stuff, and then you say like this thing goes to this node, and you write that out, and then it's the one that's drawing all the lines and mapping them out for you. So huge superset of that, I would say. And or like if you've ever done anything like where it's like math jacks or like a math expression on a web page where you get into, you know, slash fraction, frac for fraction, and all this other stuff, it always felt like this is not webby and all this other stuff. And that's where it's related to, is because LaTeX makes it really easy for doing mathematical expressions in a document. So definitely a superset of all of that. But that's one of the reasons why I looked at it, is, oh, if I want to have a diagram, how do I represent that in the document instead of always having to use a million one other tools to create an image and then remember where it lives? Especially if I want to have some data behind it that's driving that image. So we'll see how far I get in it. I don't think I'll probably ever fully scratch more than the surface, but it's kind of fun. It's expanding my brain cells a little.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm curious now for that purpose, just, you know, from a documentation standpoint, like if there's something there where, just like in Mermaid, you can define something and then like have it spit out a format that would be usable on the web. Like, mm-hmm. I look at the, like, all the stuff that, you know, their website or like the Textifier website, and it is very rotated towards like output being PDF, which,
yes,
I'm sure makes a lot of sense in whatever world this is serving. But like, if you're obviously doing something that you want to eventually publish on the web, like PDF isn't the thing you want to do. So mm-hmm. I'll be curious to see if like there's a way to take those things that you specify as LaTeX and then spit it out as a web servable image or HTML, yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, because I will have that need, is I will need to be able to generate stuff that can be on the web and don't always want to have to say, oh, go read the PDF. So I will definitely be exploring the marriage of the two.
Cool. Next up for me is, I don't know if there's a lot to say here because we've talked about it quite a bit already, but baking generative AI into production app features. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's, you know, over the last year, right, I've had a chance to play with a lot of generative AI as just a mere mortal developer, you know, grab the OpenAI APIs as one example. And then, you know, then later we talked about, oh, well, sometimes that may not make sense just to use one company's models and APIs, and instead, what would you do then? And well, there's this thing called Hugging Face, and you can go grab a model off the shelf, and they have a node module and a REST API where you can talk to those things. And then even go a step further and say, well, what if I didn't want to call a service at all? Well, then there's this thing called OLAMA that we talked about, which is like, mm-hmm, at its core, a CLI that, you know, spins up a local server on your machine that you can, you know, it gives you a REPL, and it also gives you a REST API that you can talk to it that way as well. So that was, you know, in terms of like cracking into like, how do I start using LLMs, like generative, you know, LLMs in my code. Those are a few different ways that we looked at over the last year. And then when it comes to like, great, but why am I using these things? Like, what are they giving me exactly? You know, I think that at this point we all know, but it's a point that I've been trying to make for a while, which is the reason that you see things like autocompletes and chatbots be the first thing out the door is it's potentially the most obvious use case. And it's also the safest because you're basically, obviously there's, you know, censorship and moderation aside, whatever, like all those kind of things like that, that there's the legal and policy element of it makes it tricky. But like from a technology perspective, you're basically just handing the wheel over to the LLM and saying, whatever you spit out, I'm going to pass it straight to the user.
Right.
And so like, there's a lot of use cases for that. I still use ChatGPT constantly, like as a, just a user. And at the same time, you can really see how like easy it is to just say, well, we're just going to add autocompletes, or we're just going to add text interface by, you know, to our application because it's AI and people want to see us talking about that. I hate to say it, but it is the easy thing to do, right? It just quite frankly is. And I've certainly seen a number of different things where, you know, I'm being presented with something and I'm like, great, tell me, you know, is it OpenAI that you're talking to or whatever else, right? Because we all know what's going on behind the scenes.
Right.
So I guess what I'm hoping to see is more like pushing forward like the state of the art when it comes to where in the stack the LLM is doing something and how, if at all, that gets surfaced back to the user. So instead of having it spit out, you know, kind of like text or whatever else that's then spoken to me or put in front of me or given to me as an option, is there a good way to bake LLM judgment, in air quotes, into how my code behaves so that I don't really need to bother the user with interacting with the LLM directly, so to speak? And so that's something I really want to see more of. And I know that we're going to get to that point. I just feel it in my bones. But like right now, we're still in that phase of if we can just cram an autocomplete, you know, when it's kind of text-based into an existing feature, then like that'll get us there for now. And
yeah,
more power to the folks that are doing that, I suppose. It's just that like I'm hungry for what are the things where the AI is kind of under the hood and we're not nearly as aware of it as users.
Yeah. I'm really going to be curious to see what that looks like. And like, yeah, in the vein of an LLM, but even like what other kinds of cases AI can come into play. Like, I know there's this weird mix of everyone calling things AI just because it's the hot new buzzword and stuff like that. So it becomes a little bit harder, or like if it's not a text response bot or whatever it maybe is, like how do you inform the user of what's going on? But I feel like there's so much opportunity. Like one of the things that I could easily, like I could use tons of help with is in terms of like my music production, when I use Logic is, and they actually just came out with a new mastering tool that I don't know what it all uses underneath the hood. Supposedly, I think it uses a little bit of AI to figure like, you know, what's the best mix that you should have, and then gives you, you know, here's the settings that I thought would be dialed in. Like all those kinds of things where it's not a text prompt necessarily, and it's not text output. It is actually assisting me in my creativity and either maybe providing me suggestions on here's the settings I think work here, or it's analyzing audio, video, whatever. I think that's really going to be interesting to see where that goes. Even like, and that feels like only the next obvious step. Like there's got to be more even beyond that, is what does this turn into? So I think it's really interesting where this will go in the future.
Yeah, and it should be fun to play around with. I think we're just at the space at the point in time over the last year or so where just a regular developer can show up and hack something together that is just feels really impressive. So I think, you know, making the space to do so, kind of getting past that sort of let's add the autocomplete to the thing that already existed phase, like, and then going, okay, what's next, and pushing on those edges is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't wait to see what all that turns into, because then now you're starting to really turn into Star Trek computer, and, you know, having autonomous agents that are doing useful things, and it'll be a different world in terms of how far do you trust those agents to do their things, but also could have a lot of power to unlock there.
Yeah, 100%. Cool. Well, I think we've each got one more left, and I'd love to hear what's next on your list for 2024.
So the next one on my list is not really anything that's technical or technological. Well, it is technological because I use technology to do this. But stepping outside of the realm of things like FPGA or coding your own documents, I've been looking to learn some new music techniques. So I'm a pianist. So I've been stretching myself a bit with some classical stuff. And one of the things that there's two things, classical stuff and then not classical stuff related. One of the things that I'm coming across in classical stuff a lot is this concept of polyrhythms. And so basically, if you have, for anyone who isn't a music major, imagine a set of chords and broken chords, so one note at a time. And you have one hand may have four notes in that chord, and you're going up and down, so arpeggiating that chord up and down. And then in your other hand, you have like six notes and or five notes. Or one of the songs I'm working on has a stupid number of, what is it? It's like, I forget now, but it's like 18 or something like that. It is not evenly divisible, which is the other challenge. So trying to get my brain to grok how to do one hand with one rhythm and the other hand with another rhythm and still have it make sense. That's what I'm doing a little bit when I'm not at a computer. The other thing is back into like logic and learning music production is I have always kind of wanted to have this ability to add in like rhythm tracks and stuff, but just not the, like I can have Logic do it, but I'd kind of like to be able to learn how to do it myself. So finger drumming is on my list of trying to figure out how I've got a little bit of a device. I might have to get something bigger even yet, but kind of trying to get that, learn that a little bit so that I can do a little bit more than just piano into Logic.
Yeah, that's how I used to do all of my music, was only through like an MPC style interface.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what's out there. I had a Korg pad control that was a MIDI interface, and that was my go-to for well over a decade. And it was just great. You plug it in, you could map over different channels, you could do all sorts of interesting things. But then at the end of the day, you're getting to play. So even like melodic stuff, I would try to write that on the MPC interface just as like a interesting little constraint to have to deal with. And it had its own like MIDI, you wouldn't call it a trackpad, I guess, but it was like an X and Y sort of like, it's kind of like a trackpad, right? But you could like control different things with MIDI. So for one easy example to imagine is like pitch bending.
Right.
But you could map it to different controls inside of your DAW or anything else. So I think you're going to have a lot of fun with that. And I know there's some really good ones out there now. I'm not sure if Korg pad control is still one, but Akai, I think they're the ones that were like the OG, because they were the ones that created the MPC, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find like Ableton has certain things called push and the like that are specifically geared towards using Ableton Live, which I know I don't think you use Ableton, but for folks that do, that those started coming out right around the time I started kind of decrescendoing out of music. So I never really started playing with them, but anytime I've seen them in action, they just look like they must be really fun to play with.
Yeah. Yeah. That's same sentiment whenever I see them being used. I think, I don't know if I have the same one. It is a little Korg, I think, that I have that has some pads on it. I'll have to check it, see if it's the same thing to start with. And then Yamaha, I know, recently came out with like a finger drumming kit where it's not just the grid of squares, but it's actually a line or arranged in a slightly different way. It's got decent or pretty good reviews as well. So it's an interesting world out there that I haven't really ever delved into, but I'm always like jealous of someone who can kind of who can play the drums, period. Like that's super cool. We don't have room for drums. My nephew got drums for Christmas, but it's like, I don't need something that big. Like if I can have something compact on my desk that I can tap a rhythm to, that will make my day. So something to look forward to this year.
On the polyrhythm front, by the way, so like, you know, I think it's like you can do like a triplet on one hand. Mm-hmm. Like the common example is a triplet on one hand and then like quarter notes, or not quarter, yes, eighth notes on the other. Uh-huh. It's like triplet, duplet type thing. It's like da 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 kind of thing, yes, over and over again. I was kind of just searching on that just to see what's out there, and I pasted it into our show notes, but there's a little web app called Ploop apparently that claims to help you devise polyrhythms. So maybe you'll have fun with it. I'll have to
go check that out.
For fear of not knowing where sound is coming out of, as usual, I haven't tried it, but I don't know if this thing like plays sound or what the output is. But anyways, that might be fun to noodle around with.
Yes. I will say one other little tip that I'm starting to realize helps for me, for anyone who's into polyrhythms, and I'll be curious to play with this tool. One of the pieces that I'm learning currently, it wasn't even that hard of a rhythm, so why I was having a brain block on it, but I finally took the next step of, okay, I'm going to write this out and expand and like explode the notation. So instead of, it was like, it was triplets over like duplets underneath. And so I just expanded it out and turned it. It looks worse, actually, because now it's like sextuplets because it doubled it. But I could then draw all the lines and say, well, this pulse lines with this pulse, lines with this pulse. And then it clicked. And so I used MuseScore for that one, which is a free music notation app. There's other ones out there like Dorico, and I don't remember all the other ones. FYI, that seems to be helpful. We'll see how far that actually gets me, because like when you have some of them with like 18 to 4 or what have you, that's going to be fun to figure out.
Yeah, for sure. Well, good luck to that. That sounds like a lot of fun, actually. So, that's kind of a fun one to top off your list with. And, for mine, it's kind of back into more coding nerdery type stuff, but this one's just like, I don't know, this might be the year I want to play around some Apple native something or other. I don't know. I know that you've been doing a lot with Swift over the last, yep, year at least. And every time I hear you talk about it, I'm just kind of like, I shipped a couple of apps on the App Store back in, I want to say it was like 2016 or 2017. And I was working with a couple of artists in Japan when they first released I think they called it Message Kit. Like it was the first time they were up iMessage to build apps, and kind of hoping that would be a thing, because I had just moved back to the US from Japan, where everyone uses an app called Line to chat with each other. And that app had long had the concept of stickers, and you know, there was a whole app ecosystem and like store around it. And so I was really hoping Apple would push on that a bit more, and I thought, oh, it'd be kind of fun. I know some, you know, artists that do really cool stuff back in Japan, and so I worked with them, shipped a couple of those apps, and that whole thing didn't end up going anywhere. Like even for me, like I use iMessage all the time, and for whatever reason, it's like anytime they add a new feature, like I can look at it and be excited about it, and I'm not sure if it's just, I feel like it. There's something in there that's like, I wonder if it's really a UI problem. Like,
yeah,
it is just right there above the keyboard, but there's something in there that has never quite made that click. It feels like with, at least with anybody I know, who knows, yeah. like maybe there are huge amounts of users of that stuff out there, but I just never bump into it.
Well, and it's weird because if you switch, when I don't use them in messages, but I will use them in Messenger, in Facebook Messenger. And to some degree, I sometimes curse the UX because I always find myself going the wrong direction when I want to use, add a GIF or add in a sticker reaction. And so I'm inevitably doing it wrong the first time and then doing it. But I don't know why it's harder for me to use them in messages, but I don't think about them in messages, but Facebook Messenger, sure, all the time.
Yeah. That's some, homework for Apple if they ever decide to get it. Super interested in it. I mean, they even got this thing where now I think you in messages, you can just drop an emoji wherever you want to. And I tried, they announce features for messages, I'm very interested in it. So I'll go try it. And I remember the one time I tried it, it felt like you really have to try. I don't remember what it was, there was some sub menu. I feel like, I hope I'm not misrepresenting this, but I just remember at the time feeling like that was harder than it should have been, because if I have a keyboard full of emojis, shouldn't I just be able to drag those into the message? I don't think that's how it worked, but someone can tell me if I'm totally blanking on this. So messages is kind of not an area I want to spend any more time building things in. I took those apps off the App Store within a year just because I felt like keeping them updated with API changes and OS changes in general was they shipped the next OS shipped something that broke part of my UI. And I was
lovely.
Yeah. I mean, and if it was a thing that was getting users, that's fine. I mean, updates happen, but it was just okay, this is clearly a good time for me to take these down. So I want to push into something else that I don't know, just because it feels like these are platforms I spend all of my time on. It would feel cool to not always be building in something that is Safari, but actually come into the rest of the application ecosystem or, device ecosystem.
Yeah, I have thought it would be fun. We'll see. This could be something that goes the same route is. What's his name? Is it Steve Troughton Smith or something? I don't know if I'm getting the name quite right. On Mastodon now, it's I follow him, and he's been doing Apple Vision development. Of course, that uses Swift and things like that, and the travails and the successes of that. And it's there's a part of me that goes, that would be fun to figure out. I've never been much into AR or VR headsets, but it would be a different kind of space to play around with. It would work with the Apple ecosystem. It's also very expensive, so probably not, but it feels like that could be something that would be fun to play in. But then it could also go the way of messages and, Apple does one product and never releases another version of it.
I am so torn on that thing. I mean, I'm telling myself it would be ridiculous for me to get one. I'm trying my best to forget that thing is shipping that it exists. In a few days. Yeah, because I'm all in on it already, but it whether or not I am won't obviously determine the success of this thing. So it's the first year of Apple Vision Pro is basically a dev kit as far as I'm concerned. And I really wanted to come up with an idea that was must build this on Apple Vision Pro. And I mean, I could definitely come up with some ideas, but the reality is I don't know if I'm actually going to sit down and do something like that in the first year that would be worth $3,500. So
right,
I don't know. I think that device is going to be very interesting in maybe 2 years from now, but it's going to be a slow burn to get there.
It'll take its time. Yes.
Yeah.
But there's a part of my brain that goes, it would be fun to play with.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this is a really good kind of rundown of just some fun things to look forward to in 2024. As you mentioned up front, we reserve the right to do totally different things out of and not what's on this list. I think all hackers and kind of continually have a list of here are the next things I want to try, and you're constantly reevaluating that as things out in the world change. It's a really exciting time to just kind of look forward to the next year. knowing that I'll get to play with some code because, hey, I'd rather be scripting.
Thanks for listening to this episode of I'd Rather Be Scripting. If you love scripting, terminals, Z Shell, JavaScript development, and other random technology tangents as much as we do, we'd love to hear from you. You can always leave a review on your preferred podcasting platform, or you can reach out to us via the social links on our website, idratherbescripting.com. Until next time, I'd rather be scripting.